bright sunshine. Hey ho, it makes you feel so free, standing in the top of an apple tree.
We are talking about apples on the show today to begin the probably the first 90 minutes of the show with a couple of guests. But our first guest wrote the book titled The Light Between Apple Trees. She is Priyanka Kumar, and she also wrote Conversations with Birds, among other things. She was the Leopold Writing Program's Aldo and Estella Leopold resident for August of 2020, if I'm not mistaken. She now serves on the advisory council for that program. And she's written a dandy book, and it'll be fun talking with her about apples and her experiences with them. And as we talk with Priyanka, I hope you'll join in. Tell us about the apples you enjoy. How does picking and growing apples make you feel connected with nature? Do you ever forage for wild apples? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Priyanka Kumar, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Larry. It's my pleasure.
Well, I really enjoyed your book. Give us some insight to begin with on the book's title, The Light Between Apple Trees.
Right. Well, early on while researching the book, I heard about an orchard, the Rial Orchard, which is one of the oldest in the area that I live in, and I really wanted to get in there. But the orchard is owned by a federal agency, BLM, Bureau of Land Management. And so I needed to find somebody who worked there and could open the locked codes and get me in. And so I finally made that happen one fine October morning. And we got into this orchard, and it was pretty weedy. There were a lot of fields, and it was raining, which is unusual in New Mexico. So we bushwhacked our way through these fields, trying to avoid stepping on a 7-foot rattlesnake. I mean, this place is known for its rattlesnakes. And so amidst all of that drama, then we, you know, hopped over an acequia, which is like an irrigation ditch, and then came to this glorious line of about 7 or 8 apple trees that were heavy with fruit. And I had left my water bottle behind, and I was thirsty, and I just kind of reached over and grabbed an apple. And it just, you know, standing there, I looked up, eating the apple, and I saw this line of ancient basalt hills, and I happen to know that they're rich in petroglyphs. And the sun was shining on me through these apple trees, and I suddenly, Larry, I felt at home. I felt like this is where I wanted to be. And it brought me back to my childhood, honestly. And I in a sense, the book is a journey unpacking why I feel so much at home in these old orchards.
And your interest, I mean, you've been enchanted by apples since you were a young kid, 5 years old or so.
Yeah, even going back to when I was 2 years old, and back then, so I was incredibly fortunate. For the first roughly 10 years of my life, I lived in the foothills of the Himalayas. I was born in the eastern foothills, and then we moved to the northwestern foothills, to the heart of the apple-growing region in that area. So since I was a two-year-old, I was weaving through these mother apple trees, and I experienced them as living beings towering over me. And then when I was about 4 or 5, my dad took me to this magical apple orchard, and I spent the whole day there. And I feel like it was a really pivotal experience in my life. And I won't spoil it for readers, because I worked my way back to that important memory that I think was the seed that sprouted and you know, led to my becoming a lifelong naturalist.
Yeah.
But it was only later that I found out that some of these areas that I was freely roaming in, and I guess this was a time when parents still allowed their kids to roam, and now scientists know that The area where I grew up in is among the 18 most biodiverse hotspots on our planet. So as a little kid, I didn't know that, but I was entranced by the diversity of wildflowers, the diversity of fruit, and I was eating everything, even the flowers.
And you've tried to bring that along, as I see in the book. I mean, your children are they're out doing what you did kind of as a kid.
Yeah, and as you know, with conversations with birds, we were hiking a lot to look for birds, which we still do. And at some point, the kids started to resist a little bit, as kids are prone to do. And so it was somewhat fortunate that around that time, I began to rediscover my interest in the apple, because what I've learned is that you can always take kids along with you if your destination is, you know, a nice grove of fruit trees, and they'll climb the trees and pick the fruit for you too.
Well, you live in New Mexico, which, you know, if somebody would have said New Mexico has apple trees, I would have said, you know, we've got tons of apple trees here in Wisconsin. But I think a lot of people would be like me, to be kind of surprised to hear apples grow there well. And how you, and maybe talk about how you foraged for apples around your home.
I mean, it's interesting. Yeah, you don't necessarily think of New Mexico as an apple haven. You know, we have the Southwest has been in a drought for the last 20, 22 years. So there's that. We're in a mega drought. And it's a dry area to begin with. We're in the high desert. But what a lot of us forget is that there's this rich apple history in places like New Mexico, in the Southwest. So often when we're thinking about settlers bringing apple seeds to America, we think about perhaps settlers from England or maybe Ireland. But in fact, there's a rich history that I uncovered while writing the book of settlers from France and also Spain bringing apple seeds to the area. So in New Mexico particularly, we benefited from the Spanish bringing apple seeds and planting them as early as some of the areas that I ended up doing field work in, like the Manzano Mountains. And the mountains are named for, you know, Manzano, the Spanish word for apple tree. And they were planting apple trees there certainly by the early 1700s. So during the pandemic, especially when I think I upped my hiking and my walking game.
We all did.
Right, we all did, didn't we? I began to discover these fragments of nature that I hadn't realized existed closer to me than I might have suspected. And I think one of the key things I do in the book is I come up with this concept of the microwild. And so one of the first microwilds that really impacted me was a place where I stumbled upon a private apple orchard. And not only that, but I began to see signs that a bear, and I started to call her Ursula, was coming to this apple orchard to, you know, get some sustenance. And I would see little circles of bear fur where then she would, you know, satiate it with apples. She would take a little nap. So I found it incredible that a fragment of nature could harbor such biodiversity, could support wild creatures, everything from a hummingbird to a bear. And I started to wonder, well, is it possible that there are wild or feral apple trees growing here? And so I started to hike more deeply in that area. And as I write about in the book, one of my thrilling discoveries was when I discovered that, yes, indeed, there were apple trees that had been planted here, perhaps by bears. And they were pretty darn good. They weren't spitters, I'll say. they were a good refreshment on a hot sunny day when you were hiking. So that was key. And I became really enchanted with feral apple trees and began to wonder, are there more microwilds around us? Because these are these are truly jewel-like places where people like you and me, you know, we may not have access to the true wilderness every weekend of our lives, but we have access to these microwilds. So this is where we can renew our connection to nature and really experience almost the way that an ecosystem works and sustains biodiversity.
One of the goals, frankly, of actually, I should say, of your Apple journey is something you call rewilding. What does that mean?
Yeah, so because these microwilds are such jewel-like places where we can get reconnected to nature, and they're also close to where we live, because of all of these good things, they are also under incredible development pressures. So I think it's so important that we acknowledge their value and that we figure out ways of conserving these places. But in addition to that, I believe that we can begin this process of rewilding, growing a variety of native trees and also a variety of apple trees in our own backyards. And this is something that I began to do. And I'll be honest with you, my first efforts met with complete and utter failure. And it's partly because we were trying to conserve water at the same time. Feed our apple trees with recycled kitchen water, and that just wasn't enough. And so we tried all over again, and now, you know, we have about 15 different varieties of trees that we're growing, and so it's just such a beautiful thing. I mean, I just harvested my Newtown Pippin apples, and this is an apple variety from one of the oldest apple varieties in the country, going back to 1750. And so while harvesting the apples, I was able to tell my little daughter about, you know, the history, about the fact that, Thomas Jefferson liked to brag about this apple. And when he went to Paris, he wrote a letter back saying that they don't have apples here like the Newtown Pippin. And then, you know, you can always trust Benjamin Franklin to make something of a good thing. So he decided, well, I think we should export Newtown Pippins to England. And because Newtown Pippins, they're not great lookers, I'd say, but they're great keepers. And in a time before refrigeration, you really needed apples to be able to keep well while they were being shipped for long days. And lo and behold, it became a smash hit in England, and Queen Victoria herself became a devotee. So I was able to bring all of this history to life for my kid just through, you know, the act of growing the Newtown Pippin and harvesting the fruit with her.
Oh, man. Priyanka Kumar, our guest today, she is the author of The Light Between Apple Trees. Questions for her? I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234. You could email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News. We're taking a look at apples on the show today with our guest, Priyanka Kumar. She is the author of the book, The Light Between Apple Trees. We'll be continuing that at 11:45. Wisconsin apple expert Dan Bussey will be on the show as well, and he'll talk about growing and eating apples right here in our state. He's done a lot of work on that. And it'll be fun talking with him as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You mentioned Benjamin Franklin, but you as part of the book or maybe your own interest, you visited Thomas Jefferson's home to learn about the apples that he grew. And that was a time when there were thousands or more of apple varieties being grown in the state, in the country.
Yeah, that's right. There was, you know, we have a history of almost having, I would say, like an intense love affair with apples. In states like Virginia, there was an amazing apple culture. So for a month, I was a fellow at the Center for Historic Plants, and I researched in addition to some historic Virginia orchards, I also especially researched Jefferson's South and North orchards, where at one point he was growing a staggering 170 varieties of fruit trees. So, and of course, I did struggle with the fact that he was, using slave labor to power his orchards. At the same time, I was researching and trying to get a window into the American apple culture at the time. And one of the things that most impressed me is that not only were a lot of the founding fathers growing apples, I mean, you have George Washington and also especially John Adams, but they were corresponding about apples and they were writing each other these passionate notes about the varieties that they loved. And Jefferson was literally sending boxes of plants and trees to Paris to his friends. So this was, you know, something that was a big part of people's everyday lives. So it wasn't just gentlemen farmers, you know, growing a few fruit trees, but they were really passionate about this. And one of the things that really touched me while I was in Charlottesville is that an orchard there harvested some of the Hughes crab apples that Jefferson had originally been growing, and began to distill cider from those. And they made this award-winning cider that I think won the governor's cup. And they were so excited about this and wanted me to taste the cider, and it was absolutely wonderful. So, you know, being there for a month researching apples, I also came across people where, you know, obviously we might have differences in the way we think about political issues, but I found that we could always get together and talk about apples and get excited about apples, the kinds, the varieties that we loved, and feel a little bit of a taste of that old apple culture. So I began to develop these apple friendships that, you know, I still hold on to today. So that was kind of like an unexpected benefit. Joy that came out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, you mentioned crab apples, and we can go way back in the history. And crab apples, I think you report or note that played an important role in the development of apples way back. I mean, way back.
That's right. Yeah. I like to think that in the book, I take readers through something of a scientific roller coaster to tell the true story of the apple. And we're only learning the true story in the last 20 years. So for well over 200 years, scientists believed that the primary ancestor of the cultivar apple that we eat today, this is Malus domestica, was the wild Kazakh apple, Malus siversi, which still grows on the flanks of the Tian Shan Mountains in Kazakhstan. And so everything pointed, all the morphological studies pointed to this being the primary ancestor. But around 200 years back, there was a German scientist who asked a question about, well, what about the wild European crab apple? Did that have a role to play? And back then, that was considered to be the equivalent in scientific circles of dropping a bomb. And everybody was like, no, there's no way, you know, not the wild European crab apple. But guess what? In just the last 20 years, the newest genetic studies are showing us that, yes, indeed, the wild European crab apple did have a very significant role to play in siring the apple that we eat today. So one of the things that happened is that during the Silk Route, early on during that time period, the apple, the wild Kazakh apple, began to travel both eastward to China and westward to Europe. And of course, when it was traveling through Europe, what happened? This kind of bitter, savory wild apple hybridized with the small, sour, wild European crab apple. And lo and behold, we got something like the cultivar apple that we eat today. Now, of course, that apple eventually made its way to America. It's such a transnational fruit. I feel like when I hold the apple in my hand, I feel like, there's this electric charge almost, a sense of adventure. And then it comes here to America, where settlers are planting all these apple seeds. And America, of course, becomes kind of a laboratory for new varieties. And when you plant an apple seed, most likely you'll get a spitter. You're not going to get the apple variety that you covet. But sometimes you get a wonderful variety, and that did happen here, which, you know, goes on to explain why Americans eventually were growing more than 10,000 apple varieties. I just find it to be incredible.
It is indeed. You mentioned Jean-Baptiste Lamy. Yeah, earlier, and when we're thinking about how did apples get around, he was kind of, I think you say, kind of a lesser-known Johnny Appleseed. And I found his story, and also Jesus Garcia much later, obviously. Talk about Lamy.
Lamy is a very interesting figure. He was a French missionary who grew up in a region in France where fruit growing was very important. So he, as a child, I'd like to think that he internalized the value of fruit growing. And he left for America when he was quite young still, probably around 21. And that's when he first came here as a missionary. He was very keen on coming here and spreading not only his faith, but something that he didn't talk about a lot, also spreading his great love of fruit culture. So he first settled in places like Ohio and eventually made his way to Santa Fe, where I live today, and began dreaming of making this beautiful cathedral that Willa Cather immortalizes his dream in that wonderful novel, Death Comes to the Archbishop. And so he made that cathedral, but the cathedral is what a lot of us talk about. But what we don't know about is that he also created this gem of a garden around the cathedral with many, many fruit trees. And he came to Santa Fe at a time when there weren't a lot of trees here, but he believed in crisscrossing the country by train and gathering seeds and saplings wherever he could and bringing them back here. And that's primarily what he gave to people as gifts. He would actually plant trees for them as gifts. I mean, he was this amazing person with a prescient ecological vision. I mean, this is at a time when the word ecology wasn't yet coined, but I think he believed that he, with his own hands, could create this garden of fruit trees and really demonstrate. I think it was like a demonstration garden. He could demonstrate what can be done with the land if we actually, you know, get our hands into the soil. So he had a great impact in this area, and he was bringing, you know, I mean, locally, we still talk about how big his peaches and apples were, and his strawberries. And what's interesting to me is that he built this treasure of a garden, and then after his death,
kind of went to pod.
Yeah, I mean, it's like his ecological vision wasn't really recognized by the church, and eventually the land was just kind of sold off, filled up, asphalted over, and it's a parking lot today. And I mean, it's so depressing when you look at the photos and see what glory he created to see that, all of that is just a parking lot today. I think it says a lot. It speaks to how we've forgotten some very important things. That forgetting is one of the things that may have landed us in the kind of trouble that we are in today.
Yeah. Well, there are people out there who are still at work creating community, as you talk about in the book. One of the people that I was intrigued by was Jesus Garcia, and his grafting work. Talk about him. And he was working out of, I'm trying to remember where he was working out of. Wasn't it Tucson, Arizona?
Yeah, the Tucson Mission Gardens. And yeah, I found him to be an inspirational figure. And I think, you know, one reason I included him in the book is because he shows us a pathway to what can still be done today. So, you know, we may be stuck with these parking lots, but it's still possible to get the asphalt removed, you know, as I've done around my own property. But what Jesus did is that he began to go to these old homesteads, old sites, you know, backs of churches, and began to find limbs of apple trees that he could then graft to healthy rootstock. And, you know, this work was supported by the Kino Heritage Fruit Project. And there's some good people in Tucson supporting this work. And he brought back, you know, all of these grafts and put together a whole array of new apple trees and other fruit trees. And one of the things that interested me, it was just a coincidence, but a meaningful coincidence, that at least while I was there, they ended up they were growing about 170 varieties of fruit trees, which, you know, is about the same that Jefferson was doing. So it's almost, it's inspirational in the sense that it's a nod to the past, and it shows what the possibilities are, and that some of those old varieties, thankfully, are still there and are waiting for us to go and bring them back to life. And it's still possible to do that today.
You note in one chapter, maybe it was the same chapter, I think, a University of Wisconsin conference in Madison, Wisconsin, that the note was that 9 out of 10 varieties historically grown in the U.S. are at risk of falling out of production and falling off our own tables.
That's right. And as you know, Larry, Dan Bussey has done this wonderful work of cataloging some of these apple varieties, and there are over 16,000 named varieties of apples, which is just incredible. And sadly, scarcely a fifth of those varieties are accessible to us today. So in reality, what happens is that when a person goes to a grocery store, they may see about, you know, 5 or 6 varieties, and they never really get to tap into the incredible richness of apple varieties, not just with regards to taste, but I think with regards to their historic stories, like I was describing with the Newtown Pippin. And so I think one of the things that's important that all of us do, and it's such an easy thing to do, and it's just a way to begin to walk on this path, is to get to know our local orchardists. Because they're people around us, they're caretakers of apple trees who are doing such wonderful work. And, you know, so we start buying our apples from our local orchardists and our farmers markets, where there may be an orchardist who's selling 10 varieties of apples, and they're very proud to do this. So it's so important that we support them and we talk to them and have those conversations and really get to know some of these varieties, like the Jonathan apple, for instance, which is like this red ball-like apple. It's being called the essence of the American apple. And recently I was acquiring a crate of Jonathans from an orchardist in Chimayu, and he got so excited and he said, you know, they're just the best. And then pretty soon we were talking about, you know, other old varieties like the Maiden's Blush and the Rome Beauty, which he still grows. And he was just so happy that there was a person there who was actually talking apple varieties with him. And at the end of the conversation, you know, he's this ancient guy. He put his hand out and shook his hand with me, and I took it to be a compliment. Such an enriching experience. And I would encourage listeners to, you know, just go for that and find that wherever you're living.
We have someone here who works at Wisconsin Public Radio who has a wonderful orchard just a small orchard, but there are many, many varieties, and it's really fun to go there. And you can, you know, if you ask, you can have a taste of an apple you never heard of. And there's a few that I've wound up purchasing that I didn't know existed, but I loved the taste. It's really, you're absolutely right about that. We had mentioned grafting and Jesus Garcia earlier. Grafting, I was really surprised to learn that grafting goes way, way back.
I mean, it really does have an ancient history. And what's interesting, especially in the Mediterranean regions, what's interesting to me is that for almost 200 years, American farmers were deeply suspicious of grafting. And they thought that, you know, to take the limb of one tree and then glue it to the rootstock of another tree, I mean, it seemed like an almost like a devilish act. And Johnny Appleseed himself didn't believe in grafting. And
Thoreau didn't like the taste of the apples from grafted trees, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, that's right. He had a fondness for feral trees, as I do myself. And it must be said that when you are out there hiking for a while, you know, and you come upon a feral tree, it truly is an exhilarating experience to eat from it. And it may not be the best apple variety, but it tastes really good outside. And but, you know, in early America, it didn't matter so much, I think, that people weren't grafting, because the apple wasn't primarily being used as a fruit that was being eaten. It was being grown to make cider. And you know, cider, it was almost safer to drink cider because the water was so brackish back then. So really, our early American culture was a cider culture rather than an eating apple culture. You can still grow spitters and make cider out of it. So so it seemed to have not harmed our apple culture that they didn't believe in grafting, but by and by, they came around.
Well, apples, I remember you writing somewhere that kids would have a glass of apple cider before they went off to school.
Yeah, that's right. And not just that, but, you know, our founding father, John Adams, had a cider habit, and he wouldn't dream of starting his day without a gill of cider. And he believed very staunchly that it was a health-giving habit. And I think he was right. You know, today we're finding out all the flavonoids in apples and all the different ways that they support our health. But John Adams was so deeply into it that he was not only, he and his wife Abigail, I mean, there's an amazing love story there. Not only were they making their own cider, but they were growing their own apple trees. And he was experimenting with seaweed, putting seaweed in his compost pile, and then using a hired worker to spread it in his meadow and, you know, nurturing his trees. I mean, it was his dream that one day a tree, you know, an apple tree grown by his hand would produce apples that his grandkids would be able to eat. So I find it really inspiring to know some of those stories. And I think that there's something that we can learn from them today.
You mentioned the Wolf River apple in the book. And actually, you contacted Dan Bussey, who will be with us next, about it.
And that was an amazing, amazing experience, because now I've been going to Las Golondrinas, the ranch of the swallows, for something like 17 years now here in New Mexico. And I was just there last weekend for the Harvest Festival, and I've been going every single year, sometimes many times a year. And, you know, being there and harvesting from their old, old apple trees was one of the experiences that I would say inspired the book. And at some point, one of the directors of the orchard gave me a tour of the trees that are not accessible to the public. And I asked him what variety some of these very old trees were. and he called them the wolf willow variety. And I came back home and looked at all the different apple databases that I had, and I couldn't find for the life of me an apple called a wolf willow. So I was very puzzled, and then I started looking at what the characteristics are of this apple. This is a large red apple with kind of a sandy crown, and it's a baking apple. It, you know, you could eat it, but it's a little tart, and it's the characteristics were awfully close to the characteristics of the Wolf River apple, which, you know, is a Wisconsin apple. So I got a little suspicious, and I got in touch with Dan Bussey, who very kindly, you know, confirmed my intuition that this Wolf Willow, so-called, was actually the Wolf River. And so I got very excited and began to delve deeper into the history of this apple. And it turns out that this variety was actually brought to Quebec by French settlers in the 1600s. And this also hit close to home because, you know, my husband, Michael, his maternal ancestry goes back, and they were French settlers who came to Quebec in the 1600s. So it's an illustration of how apples can really connect you to history. And at some point, a woodsman brought it down from Quebec to Wisconsin and planted it along the Wolf River in Wisconsin, perhaps in around 1856. I know it was seen growing there in 1875. So it has, you know, some really interesting history in Wisconsin that we could still explore. And at some point along the old Santa Fe Trail, it made its way down to New Mexico, and lo and behold.
Well, I have to tell you, Priyanka, that it's been a delight talking with you. And we haven't begun to cover everything that you have in your book that is so entertaining, informative. There's a strong sense of climate and climate change that we really haven't touched on like we probably should have. But I really appreciate your time. I enjoyed your book a lot. I'll probably give Dan Bussey a copy of it. He's giving me a thumbs up. He's right outside waiting to come in. Priyanka Kumar, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a joy. Thank you so much, Larry.
A real pleasure. Priyanka Kumar is the author of The Light Between Apple Trees, the subtitle, Rediscovering the Wild Through a Beloved American Fruit. You're going to like the book. I'm pretty sure of that. And coming up, Dan Bussey. Who else to talk about Wisconsin apples? I'm Larry Neeler for WPR News. 100 times, hey-ho, it makes you feel so free, standing in the top of an apple tree. Makes you feel so fine, looking out across the orchard in the bright sunshine. Hey ho, it makes you feel so free, standing in the top of an apple tree. Well, if there's anybody who knows about apples in Wisconsin, it's Dan Bussey. He's written a 7-volume book, I guess we could say, or books, about their history in the United States and Canada. Larry Neeler here. Great to have Dan back with us again to answer your apple questions. Dan's, I would call him an apple historian, a cider maker. He's the orchardist for the Silverwood Park Heirloom Apple Orchard near Edgerton. And he wrote that, as I mentioned, that 7-volume illustrated history of apples in the United States and Canada. And it is a dandy. And as we talk with Dan, I hope you'll join in, want to hear from you. Do you have heirloom apples on your property? What would you like to know about their history? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. www.thebeginthetalk.org. Dan Bussey, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
It is a pleasure to be here.
How's the season treating your orchard, Silverwood Park?
It's a little different this year. I don't know if the early weather, the wet, and then it got hot, and then it got cold, and it got dry. A lot of apples are dropping early this year, and the crop is a little lighter than usual. I've been hearing that around the state as well.
How many apples, trees, or varieties do you have?
Oh, gosh. I know I'm north of 600 right now. It's probably closer to 7.
That is amazing.
That's a small collection. No.
Small collection. Oh, my goodness me. How do you harvest your apples? Do you machine, hand, or what do you do?
One at a time.
Oh, one at a time. Oh, what's your favorite to eat right now?
Oh, gosh. There's there's so many. One of my favorite apples is an English dessert russet called Lord Hindlip. It's a russeted apple. It just has a wonderful sweet, tart, acid balance. It's an apple that makes me happy to eat it.
Cal in Menominee, Michigan is already online with a question for you. Let's go there. Cal, hello.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. I have a small orchard, nothing like yours. I only got about 20, 25 apple trees. They're about 24 years old. I fertilize them almost every year, and they're about 8 inches in diameter or so. They're really healthy-looking trees and are loaded this year. The problem I have is I have about 4 or 5 of them. The leaves all but fell off, except for the very top. And the tree looks dead, but I went out and checked the buds and the stems and everything is still green. And I'm just wondering, and they're not dwarf apples. They're just the regular ones. And I'm just wondering if it's because it got so dry, they dropped early. The apples are still on the tree, though, and they're almost hard to get off. It's like they're stuck on the branches, and you have to really shake them to get them down if you want them down.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of that this year. Early defoliation, early apple drops. In a lot of cases, some trees are still hanging on to theirs. No, the vagaries of the weather certainly are what's causing that. And your tree is not dead. It's definitely gone into a more of an early dormancy.
There you go, Cal. Too bad. For this year, but hopefully things will turn around as we go down the years. Hopefully next year is going to be better. I just to bring up, we're not going to talk about apple disease the whole time here, but I wonder about, Priyanka talked about rapid apple decline in the country.
Yeah.
Is that a problem here?
It can be a problem. Now, the issue with the rapid apple decline is that most orchards now are going to plant their trees on a more of a fruit wall, dwarfed stock, which means it has a fairly shallow root system, and the trees are planted pretty close together. Well, anyways, the shallow root system is a little bit of a problem when you get a dry year. When those trees dry out, they can suffer badly, and that's where some rapid apple decline or sudden apple decline, as they also call it, happens. I've heard of it more and more. I know it happened in Pennsylvania quite a little bit. But and if you irrigate, you probably might be able to get away with that. But this shallow root system is, you are suspect to the vagaries of the weather.
Gretel in Herbster has a question for you. Let's go there. Gretel, hi. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call.
Hi there. Thanks for such a great program. So I'm calling for Herbster, but I'm actually wondering about planting in central Michigan. And in particular, if there are varieties that grow well in wetland areas. We have a lot of wetlands in our house there in central Michigan, and also a lot of deer. So just
a lot
wondering
of deer.
If you have any advice.
I think you're going to have more problem with the deer than anything else. They're always going to keep you humble.
What about varieties? Are there apple varieties that do better in wetland-type areas?
Well, like the Wolf River. It grew up in blue clay soil on the east bank of the Wolf River, so it was definitely in wet areas. They tolerate wet areas, I think, pretty well. For the most part, unless they're just absolutely waterlogged and saturated. But I think apples will do fine.
And maybe some others as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Lots of varieties available, especially in central Michigan. I think the climate there, I know there's a gentleman in Michigan that has at least 1,400 varieties.
Wow.
And he's doing a roll. I think I'm trying to think exactly where he is, but I think it's close to central Michigan. So lots of possibilities for you.
Gretel, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's turn to Joe in Rhinelander. Joe, hello to you.
Hello. I just thought I'd share that a good friend of mine and I make apple cider every year.
Good for you.
We make 80 to 100 gallons a year. And some of it's hard, some of it's regular fresh cider that we freeze. But it's a good activity for retired folks.
Ah.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
And as we didn't really get into it much, but apple cider, I mean, that was the early settlers, and Johnny Appleseed. I think his apples were for cider making.
Yeah. Hard apple cider was a standard in a beverage in the day. I mean, I know different presidents would have a mug of it before they went to office, and I think that would maybe do current residents in the office the same benefit. We'll see about that. But anyways, a lot of times it was safer to drink than the water. So cider was just a standard beverage that everybody consumed, even kids. It was very mildly alcoholic, so it wasn't ever really that strong. But it was a very popular beverage, and we've sort of lost track of that.
Dawn emailed us. They have an apple tree. It's about 25 feet tall, about 20 years old, has three main branches. Would it be possible to trim it back 8 to 10 feet to make the apples more accessible without hurting the tree? They're unsure what variety of apple they have.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of ways to go about it. You never want to cut more than a third of the overall canopy any given year, because otherwise you're going to stress the tree too much. So look at the branches that are mostly vertical. Those are the ones that you probably want to eliminate. Try to encourage horizontal branching. But by pruning, remember that you're going to have to follow up, because as you prune, it's going to invigorate that tree and it's going to send out a whole lot more branches to try to compensate. But yeah, you can bring the height down.
But maybe 20%, did you say?
About 20 to 30% of the canopy. Yeah. Not much more than that.
And when would you do it? What time of the year?
Oh, definitely after the worst of the cold weather. If you're making really large cuts, never make them so they're absolutely flat. Otherwise, rain can catch on them. Try to angle them a little bit, but do it. I typically do late February into March after the worst of the cold weather is over. You can introduce some tissue damage into the trunk of the tree by doing that, and it just weakens it overall in the long run.
Have you discovered any new varieties since we last talked?
Oh, gosh. I've run into a few, and I have sent off some samples to be DNA tested to find out whether they match anything else. This was in the same area that I found, a friend of mine found this apple we've determined to be the Dockham Russet, which came out of Sauk City. And it was planted in a row just down from that tree, and we could tell it was commercial. And it's a really nice apple. I really like it, but I have no idea what it is. So hopefully if we get a match, it'll tell me, but I'm actually looking forward to if it doesn't match anything else. That means I've got to do some hunting and figure out what this thing is.
Oh, man. And the testing is done where?
We can send leaf samples in a test tube that has a desiccant in it off to Washington State University. There's a website called myfruittree.org that you can request samples of test tubes. They will send it to you, and for $50, they will see if it matches anything in their database of several thousand varieties.
Oh, man. Dan Bussey, our guest, he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today as we talk with him about apples in Wisconsin and, well, apples probably anywhere else. He pretty much knows what's going on for sure. And you can join in the conversation. I hope you do. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News. And then we will be back. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. We'll be right back. Great to have you along today on WPR News, where we talk about all things apples today with Dan Bussey, apple historian and cider maker. He's the orchardist for the Silverwood Park Heirloom Apple Orchard, located near Edgerton, Wisconsin. Dan's the author of the 7-volume, absolutely beautiful, illustrated history of apples in the United States and Canada. As we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Do you visit local apple orchards in your area, or maybe you drive a ways to maybe make a day trip out of getting to an apple orchard or our new ones to get your apple fix? Maybe you want us to ID a type of apple for you. Maybe you have another question. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, and the email address, talk@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, Bill in Oregon, Wisconsin, emailed us and wondering if by any chance you've ever explored the old Donald Farm orchards at what is now Donald Park in Dane County near Mount Vernon. There are at least 3 species scattered along the trails, and they look and taste like cider apples.
Interesting. I'm going to have to check that one out.
You haven't done it yet?
No, I've not been there.
So it's the Donald Park near Mount Vernon. All right. Peter in Blanchard emailed us. Peter's brother had an apple tree which a panel of apple experts were unable to identify, so they named it after Peter's family. Doesn't say the name of the apple now, but probably a Blanchard apple, maybe. When he had to take down the tree, Peter received a graft from it, and they've had it now for 20 years. It's a late-ripening apple, but tastes good and seems to be insect-resistant. So nice. Far as Peter knows, it's the only existing apple tree of its kind, and it's fun to grow.
That's what we look for, are those rare remnants that still exist, that someone has taken the time because they love it and they keep it around. So I'm just thrilled to know that he got a graft of this and had it planted, and it's doing really well for him.
Yeah, that's great. How do you find it, heirloom apple varieties? Anyway?
Well, it's kind of a tough thing because you don't go looking for heirloom apples in old orchards so much as basically going to old farmsteads, remnant houses that you find. I was just in Viroqua area a couple of weeks ago and in some of these narrow little valleys. And we were taking a hike, and all of a sudden we found this iron bridge that basically crosses Little Creek. The road wasn't there anymore, but the bridge was. And near it was a collection of about 5 trees, and they were planted. You could tell they were in a row, so you know it was a planted variety, a cultivated variety that someone put there. So those are those things that we look for and love. And we found some good apples there.
And the process of identifying a new variety, I mean, how long does it take? You said earlier you send samples.
Oh, right, sending leaf samples in. It's a slow process, and I sent some samples in earlier this spring, and I'm still waiting. I know it can take maybe 6 to 8 months or longer to get results, but I'm just waiting for that day when I get the news of what it is, if it is something that exists already, or is it something completely different.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. What are your favorite orchards? I mean, you got your own orchard, but you visit others around the state. What are some of your favorites?
I always have to say Sky High is a fun one for me to go to. I love it up there. And you go there on the weekend at this time of year, and it's a madhouse of people there. They have a lot of trees. It was one of the old Wisconsin Horticultural Society experiment stations. And so it's
and
been around
located?
A long time. They're located off Highway 12, south of Baraboo, north of Prairie du Sac.
But a good place to visit.
Yeah, it's a nice place to visit. There are so many good orchards. I suggest anyone that's near you, go visit them. See what they've got. See what apples they carry. You know, go a couple of times, and you'll see different apples during the season, early ones versus late ones. Get to know what they've got, and that's the fun of it. Some of them carry a lot of the old-fashioned. Some of them have mostly the new ones, but you don't know until you look.
What are the some of the oldest orchards in the state?
Oh, one of the older orchards I know, I think, is Hauser's, way up in Bayfield. the earliest apples that were planted in Bayfield area were actually in Michigan, Michigan Island, way out there. There was a lighthouse keeper by the name of Roswell Pendergast, and I think he came and he had spare time when he didn't have to be out at night, and he planted an apple orchard there, and he was selling apples into town, and eventually they started planting apple trees in the community, and there's a couple of old remnant trees that are at Hauser's up north of town there.
They're still there.
They're still there.
Oh, man. What is, obviously, they must have had some care, and they must have had the right kind of temperature and conditions to grow it. What are some of the, and so that makes it a long-lived tree, but what are some of the common mistakes people make when they try to grow apple trees?
Biggest thing is they plant a tree and they walk away from it. And they don't realize that lots of little things love to come and eat the apple tree and be a problem. Mice and voles are probably the worst problem you're going to have. So I always suggest if you plant an apple tree, find some way to protect the trunk of the tree so it doesn't get girdled. If you can find some metal window screening and just make a little tent around it, that's a really good way to do it. If you have deer problems, well, then you have to worry about putting a little bit bigger fence to try to keep them away. They are pretty wily and will... So rabbits will eat... Okay, mice get everything below, deer from above, and rabbits get everything in the middle.
What's the best way to grow them? I mean, are seedlings available? For an heirloom? Do you have to propagate from the original? What?
More nurseries are carrying a lot of the heirloom varieties. There's a few specialty ones that do, and then there's others that sell scionwood if you learn how to graft fruit trees, which is really easy to do. There's Maple Valley Orchard Nursery over in Suamico, sells a lot of really interesting varieties of apples, and I think they do a really fabulous job with the cuttings they send out. I worked with him on some projects around UW Oshkosh, grafting trees, Wisconsin varieties for the orchard up there on campus.
Dennis emailed us, when Dennis sees golden delicious apples in grocery stores, people may wonder why that name. Dennis said he's had a real golden delicious apple from a tree. It was golden and delicious.
Yeah, it can actually be. How you grow an apple makes all the difference in the world. Most trees, if they're just naturally grown, they aren't irrigated per se, only just to keep the tree alive initially when it's young. But I think there's a real depth of flavor that irrigation kind of washes out, if it's over-irrigated, I should say. I mean, it's something you have to have. You're selling apples by the pound. You certainly want a nice big apple for people to munch on. But I've seen some semi-dwarf and full-size trees that have that really deep root system that accesses the terroir and the minerals in the soil. And I think the flavor is just that much better on apples like that. But I'm old-fashioned in that regard.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. There's also, there have been some really popular apple varieties that started in a place, and then because of they tasted so darn good, they're grown in other places, and the flavor is just not the same.
No, it isn't. I mean, where they came to be and really popular, it says something about the soil and the climate and everything that just made that apple really good. You take that out of its element and you go someplace else with it, and a lot of times it isn't as good. It just isn't. We should think about apples being more regional than throughout the whole country, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Trying to find the right words.
Esty in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Esty.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for this very interesting show. I have two questions. One is I have only two apple trees in my backyard, but I don't ever want to spray them, and I pay the price, right?
No.
And I wonder what you know about... How can I do it without using chemicals? And obviously, from the first part, all these people who grew them 200-300 years ago knew how to do that. So that's question number one. Question number two, again, going back to the first part, Priyanka herself is from the Himalayas, but she was talking just about, you know, old white people growing apples. And I was wondering if there's history of Native Americans growing apples or people from other parts of the world, you know, Latin America, Africa, etc., bringing their own variety, or maybe they don't grow there. I'm interested in knowing about that. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
And I will say that Priyanka does cover that in her book, but we didn't get to it. But go ahead. A couple of questions here. One, growing apples without spraying. And then the question about Native Americans or other groups in other parts of the world who grow apples.
Yeah, you can grow apples without having to spray. I think you need to be vigilant as to dealing with certain hatches of insects at certain times of the year and knowing what's out there. And sometimes, like in Japan, they'll wrap bags around their apples to protect them, and so they don't get. But I haven't sprayed apples in a long time, and I get a majority of my crop that's very clean, very nice. There are those sort of skin funguses like sooty blotch and fly speck, which they look bad. They make your apple kind of smudgy looking, but that's just on the skin. It's superficial, and it doesn't affect the flavor whatsoever. We're so used to everything being absolutely spotless when you go into the store and we see an apple that's got a few blotches, we kind of stay away from it, but they're perfectly fine. Habitat is everything. Having habitat for beneficial insects that prey on the insects that prey on apples gives you balance. And when I worked at the Seed Savers Exchange, we had habitat, and I always thought it was so nice to have so many good apples without really any problems at all. Things happen, but most years, I had a good crop.
Is there a book or something that somebody like Esty could use that goes into that in more depth?
Oh, yeah. The Apple Grower by Michael Phillips, who's a good friend of mine who's now passed away. He wrote a really good book on organic culture about apples, about nutrition made a lot of difference. I think he felt that if the tree was healthy, it tended to ward off insect pests as much as anything else. So that's a good one out there. I think it's still available. I believe Chelsea Green Publishing probably still has it.
And his name again?
Michael Phillips. The Apple Grower.
The Apple Grower. Esty, there you go. Oh, and what about and certainly Priyanka talks about this in the book, about other ethnic.
Oh, ethnic groups always brought stuff with them.
Yeah.
When they settled here in this part of the world. We've got apples from Norway. We've got apples from Italy. We've got apples from Germany that people brought either cuttings of, or they managed to get trees on the boat and they brought them over, or they took the seeds of those varieties and planted them, and they came up to be something similar to what the parent was.
Esty, thank you again. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Stella.
Hi. I have a question. I have loved apples all my life, and I used to be able to eat almost anything, but as I've gotten older, my teeth have gotten sensitive, and I can no longer eat tart apples, or even sweet tart apples. I need to find sweet apples. And I found one, Ambrosia, and I was wondering if you could give me the names of some other sweet varieties that I might be able to find somewhere.
Ah, there's an old classic heirloom variety called Tolman Sweet that was widely planted all over Wisconsin. And I've seen that in different orchards already this fall. So it's an apple that's around. It's a nice sweet apple.
Tolman?
Tolman Sweet, T-O-L-M-A-N.
Stella, there you go. Thank you for calling. Diane and Cashton, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I have an apple tree that grew in my garden box, and I noticed it in the spring, and I've left it and kind of protected it. It's probably about a foot high now, and it will have to come out of the garden box.
Yeah.
Please tell me how to take care of that.
Ah. You want to transplant it on your property, Diane?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, actually, right now is not a bad time to do some fall transplanting. Dig up as much as you can and get as much of the root as possible. And then you find a spot where you're going to put it. Check that out. Dig that first. And you can sort of condition the soil a little bit if you need to put any amendments, if it's rocky or if it's really sandy or anything like that. But if you can dig as much of a root ball as possible and then place that gently into the hole and water it in really well, and then obviously protect it from critters that will find it otherwise, and you should do fine.
Yeah, you're going to, and spread those roots out. Flay them out. Don't get them in, you don't want them to start circling.
Yeah, and if you can, dig a good size hole, and if you don't have to disturb the root ball, if you can get all of it, you're going to be all right. And a foot tall, your regular spade shovel should contain the entire root system.
Diane, good luck. I hope you have good luck with it. Nancy in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, this is a great day for apple. I have a neighbor's tree has this huge, it's very old, I'm guessing at least 100 or 80 years old. And when the apples all drop, they're way high up, you can't really reach them. And they don't bruise at all. I have picked them for years. I get bucketfuls and I make applesauce with it. And it's sort of crispy. It doesn't have a big taste, but they're really good. And I've never met an apple that didn't rot on the ground. And that's where I get them all, and they're in beautiful shape. Somebody thought they were called Duchess, and I don't know. I'm trying to figure out. This tree is just marvelous, and it's just amazing.
Duchess is an old variety. It's been around a long time. It generally ripens here in the southern part of the state, sort of early-ish September, sort of. It's a little bit earlier season than this. But up in Duluth, I expect it could be a little bit later. If it's a striped apple, I think you definitely have the Duchess. There was an old storage apple called York Imperial that was really popular, and it was a tough apple, and it ripens late, and it's a apple that keeps all winter long without much problem in the root cellar.
What does it look like?
I believe it's been a while since I've seen one, but it's more of a yellow apple, I believe, and I think it has more of a solid blush to it in places. It's not striped as far as I know.
Nancy, what does yours look like? Your apple.
Mine are, they're not real big, but they're not small. They're good palm size. They do have stripes, and they're very sturdy. I just can't believe they don't breathe easily.
It could be Duchess.
I'd love to find a Duchess tree, but they're pretty old. So do they even grow them anymore?
Oh, yeah. Duchess is one of my favorite pie apples. I love Duchess for that.
So northern Minnesota, Duluth, Minnesota, so just right next to Superior.
Yeah, and that's a great place to grow apples.
There should be somebody in your area that's selling Duchess.
Yeah.
I would think. Yeah. So give that a shot, Nancy. Thank you very much for calling. Heidi wondered if you, in an email, if you recommend fertilizing apple trees.
You can fertilize, but don't use much nitrogen. Try to avoid that if possible. You're going to encourage a lot of leafy growth, which is going to make you very susceptible to fire blight, which is a real bad problem. Usually during blossom time, it infects your trees and it will kill your trees overnight. It's that bad.
Delight in Gurnee, Illinois, I believe. We'll go there.
No,
hi.
Gurnee, yeah. Wisconsin.
Oh, Gurnee, Wisconsin.
Gurnee, Wisconsin. Oh. That's up near Lake Superior.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Yes. We are in the snow belt, so we do get 4 feet of snow, although the last 2 years have been very mild. We have a variety of ages of trees. We have four that are 20 years old, and then we have 13 and 8 and even 6 and 3 years old. And we have about 30 trees, and they're not all in the same location on our property, but I'm having trouble getting, if they blossom, I don't receive apples or just a few, maybe two or three. I did call a fertilizer, and I think it was in Michigan, and they said, well, maybe they need calcium. So this is the first year I did spray calcium on the ground underneath their drip vine, but I'm not sure of what to use. I'm afraid to do something to stress them out.
Yeah, and you might be, if you're fertilizing a lot, you may, Dan, you were just talking about not using nitrogen.
Yeah, potassium and phosphorus is fine, but really keep it low on nitrogen. It can cause more problems. Now, putting calcium on is going to be a slow uptake into the tree. A lot of times they'll use foliar applications of calcium. I know that's an issue, I think, with Honeycrisp, that they need a fair bit of calcium. So there are foliar sprays that you can spray on your tree while the leaves are there, and it doesn't hurt anything. But if you're not getting a lot of blossoms, there are issues, of course, with cold weather snaps, and if it gets below 28 degrees when the trees are in bloom, it's going to hurt them pretty bad. Some trees just need every other year to build enough energy back up to be able to produce fruit again. So there are several conditions. They need a lot of light, and that makes a lot of difference, too.
Yeah. Delight, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Somebody wants to know, what's the best apple for making cider? And, you know, one variety, a lot of people use a couple, three varieties.
Oh, at least. I always felt the more varieties you can put in cider, the better flavor, the all-around richness of it. If you're going to stick with a single variety, my favorites are always the russet apples. They have probably a better sugar acid balance, I've mentioned before, and they ferment down to just a really pleasant cider by themselves. There aren't many single varietals that I think do as good as the russet apples, if you can find those.
What are your thoughts on the apples you find in the local supermarket?
There are some interesting ones. One I've run across recently, it's a Honeycrisp seedling. It's called a sugar bee. And I guess it was developed in Minnesota, and the rights to it got bought out by a consortium, I think, in Washington State, and now they're growing it all over the place. But there's one orchard in southeastern Minnesota that I'm not going to mention because they were a test orchard for it, and they cannot sell it under that name, but they have it. And it's really locally popular, and I like that apple a lot. It's really good.
Do you peel your apples before you use them in a pie or an apple crisp?
I've always peeled mine, but I know people who don't. That's a personal preference. It's fine. Some apples have a real thick skin, and I think I'd have a hard time dealing with
that. Yeah, that's true. It's nice. You kind of get a little different color going.
I'd rather put a red-fleshed apple than you got color.
Yeah. That's a good tip, Dan.
Right. My mother was a home ec teacher, and she taught her sons to bake, considering our dubious employment or marital prospects, at least we wouldn't starve. So I can make a pretty mean apple pie, and I will always have one that makes a sauce, another one that apples are firm and they'll keep their shape in the slice, and then add a red-fleshed apple to it for color, and you just have the most beautiful thing in the world.
Dan, it's always a pleasure. Yes. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I hope you'll come back and do it again.
Absolutely.
Dan Bussey, our guest today, he is an orchardist of the Silverwood Park Heirloom Apple Orchard near Edgerton, 600 varieties or so. He's the author of the 7-volume, just wonderfully illustrated, History of Apples in the United States and Canada. 7 volumes. Great to have him with us. Well, we've spent an hour and a half talking about apples. We're going to turn our attention to some whooping cranes next. We got a couple of guests to talk about whooping cranes and avian flu as well. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. We're turning our attention to cranes. You know, late last month, I think it was, a female whooping crane named Ducky died from highly pathogenic avian influenza. Ducky lived in the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo, a lovely place to visit. But her death was the first time a hooper has died in North America from this flu. And so now scientists at the International Crane Foundation, of course, are working to safeguard the remaining flock And we're going to talk with a couple of guests from the foundation about the status of the Whooping Crane Foundation. International Crane Foundation. And Ann Lacey's one of them, been with us a number of times, director of the foundation's Eastern Flyways program in North America. Ann, welcome back.
Well, it's so good to be back. Thank you.
And Dr. Diane Boone, Diana is director of conservation medicine at the foundation. Diana, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Larry.
As we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. Questions about avian influenza, maybe, or maybe about the Crane Foundation itself. I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Maybe we could just start by talking about highly pathogenic avian influenza. Just what really is it?
Yeah, thanks, Larry. So avian influenza showed up in North America in late 2021, 2022, and it has been decimating wild bird populations in addition to causing problems with commercial poultry, some of the production farms for some of the game birds, and last year in dairy cattle with it being found in the milk that they produced. It is a highly infectious disease. It evolves really quickly, so we're seeing some more and more virulence in the virus, and we're seeing with the ducky and the whooping crane that died, that they've been at Horicon Marsh for years as part of the reintroduction program. And to have this be the first time is really an indication of how widespread this virus is becoming and how much of a problem it's becoming for wild populations.
So it happened right on the International Crane Foundation grounds?
It actually happened. We release cohorts of chicks each year, and 8 chicks had been released and were in basically a soft release pen at Horicon Marsh, and that's where Ducky picked up the virus, and that's where Ducky died.
So the International Crane Foundation grounds have not experienced...
No.
chime in here, Ann.
Yeah, that's what when we found out that after Ducky passed away and testing indicated that she was positive for HPAI, that initiated a whole string of precautionary measures that we've had in place for years, but we have it in levels, and Diana has, and people before her have had these protocols set up, so we know what to do when there is avian influenza in the state or in the county or, God forbid, on our site.
Yeah.
And so we went from stage nothing to 4, which is the highest precaution on our site, to protect our birds that are resident on our site, but also our staff and then our field personnel that are going off-site, on-site to these places. So that was initiated immediately.
Yeah. Well, and as I think about it, I mean, they're occurring in places where the birds are in close concentration. I mean, there's thousands of geese, or there's thousands of chickens in one building.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is way different than than what you have at the Crane Foundation.
Yes. Yeah. So our site is clean. So we made sure that we passed that incubation period that is requisite, I guess is the word for it.
Yeah.
We made sure that our site was clean, but we maintain those protocols for staff coming and going from areas that may have the virus. So we just assume that if it's out in the field where there are waterfowl present, that it could be there, and we make sure that we separate that distance,
yeah,
that there's a break between our field work and on site.
Well, whoopers are, I think they're high, they call them highly endangered, isn't it? I mean, remind me what that actually exactly means.
For whooping cranes, it means that there are only, right now we have 65 in Wisconsin. There is an estimated about 560, 575 in the wild population flying between Aransas and Wood Buffalo National Park in Canada, so the original population. So that's not very many of any one species. So it is a very endangered species. And the reason for the population here in Wisconsin is to get a self-sustaining population that will eventually contribute to the downlisting of it, so it will no longer be endangered.
Yeah. And for those who aren't familiar, I mean, they're not necessarily all that easy to tell if you see one flying them 400 yards away, but what do they look like?
So people are familiar, I hope, familiar with our sandhills. Very, very ubiquitous in the state. Gray, still big. They stand on two legs and can look you in the eye. But when you see a whooping crane, they are lily white with those beautiful black wingtips. So the big, big white bird with black wingtips flying with sandhills, maybe?
Yeah,
sometimes. It'll be a whooping crane. Yeah.
And how big a threat do you think the avian flu is to the whooper population, Diana?
I think it's a very substantial threat because what we see is mostly during migration, so the spring and fall migration. And we know that we lost, we don't know the exact numbers, but up to 2,000 to 3,000 sandhill cranes on their wintering grounds this past spring. And whooping cranes, you know, are tightly interwoven in those flocks. So if we're seeing that amount of death with sandhill cranes, there's a really good probability that the chance of exposure for whooping cranes is higher and higher with each season, and there's more prevalence of the virus in the environment.
So I'm trying to figure out, what do you do to spread, to keep this, or limit, I guess. We're not going to get rid of it entirely, I don't think, but What are people doing to try to limit the spread of this disease among cranes?
You know, that's a great question, and it's for cranes and it's for wild bird species in general. You know, we don't really have a vaccination that's been approved. The only species that has is California condor, but that is in discussions. We also talk to a lot of people about, is there ways that we can kind of monitor the virus and have an idea if it's coming to a certain area? Do we watch those cranes a little bit closer? And then the rest of it is really just being aware of where the virus is, how the virus presents, you know, because we're not going to go and catch the 65 birds that are in Wisconsin and bring them back into captivity for a multitude of reasons. They are wild birds. They do get exposure. You know, the hope is that they develop some immunity with continued low doses of exposure. And a lot of the conversations that have happened in the zoo veterinary world, wildlife veterinary world, is, you know, your exact question, like, what, how do we protect our birds, and, you know, how do we, you know, make sure that we're not having mass mortality? So there's a lot of mostly preventative measures that are in place, or monitoring measures as much as possible.
Keeping them, I'm just trying to, my daughter is works at the she graduated from college last year in biology and is now at the Topeka Zoo, where she's got a full-time job there. But I'm, you know, I was down there visiting, and you're in the avian areas. You might see birds flying in from wherever, or, you know, ducks, wild ducks coming in and sitting amongst the other ducks.
I see this. There's two prongs. So that's something that we do on our site up in Baraboo to keep our cranes safe, is we can exclude waterfowl either by top netting or putting our birds inside. But something else to consider with wild birds is ensuring that they have enough habitat where they can spread out. It's those concentrated groups of birds, like you were saying. And that has there's been other populations of cranes that were hit very, very hard. In those first years where highly pathogenic avian influenza first came out, Eurasian cranes in the Hula Valley of Israel, hooded cranes in Izumi in Japan. And that was one thing that we had always thought it was going to happen, and sure enough it did. And so this year also happened with sandhills. So ensuring that we have adequate habitat all through the flyway so they can spread themselves out and be at less risk, that's key as well.
On those flyways, though, they like to stay together. I mean,
I think some of it is, yeah, they like each other's company, maybe. Or sure. There's safety in numbers, certainly. But some of it is also driven by there are fewer and fewer places that they can find safe roosting in those shallow, large, shallow, open wetlands.
So, I'm looking here and thinking it's time for us to take a little short break. And just a reminder that we're talking with Diana Boone, Director of Conservation Medicine at the International Crane Foundation, and Ann Lacey, who's Director of the International Crane Foundation's Eastern Flyways Program in North America. Questions for them, maybe about avian influenza, but maybe about the International Crane Foundation or cranes in general. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with a couple of folks from the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo, Dr. Diana Boone and Ann Lacey, and Diana's Director of Conservation Medicine, and Ann is the Director of International Crane Foundation's Eastern Flyways Program in North America. Questions for them, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. And when, you know, for those who aren't familiar, maybe we should talk a bit about the International Crane Foundation. Would you give us the background of the organization?
Well, the International Crane Foundation has, since its humble beginnings in Baraboo, Wisconsin, we are 52 plus years young. Yeah, so we have been going strong for that many years. International conservation, helping people and communities as well as cranes in 50 countries and 5 continents. But at our site in Baraboo, we have all 15 species of crane that exist worldwide. It's the only place in the world that has them all. And we tell their story, tell the threats to them, and how we are working to ameliorate those threats to keep them and their ecosystems secure.
Well, I have to tell you, I've been going up there for years and years, but thinking back to the sort of the original site, and this is the same site, but and what you have now after that big remodel, how many?
Yeah.
It's not that long ago.
No, we were supposed to open in 2020, so we had a little bit of a delay there, but so much better. But yes, yeah, brand new exhibits and visitor center, and it's still even new to us, even though it's about 5 years old.
It is amazing, and I guess my point is, if you visited 10 years ago and you think, well,
come on back, yeah,
it's I've been there once. You're gonna be really surprised.
And our nature trails, I can't yes. forget about our beautiful prairies. They were spectacular this year. It was such a good growing season.
Yeah. Joe in Menasha has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Hi there. I have two little things. I spend a lot of time outdoors observing nature, including being quite aware of our honeybees and impact on crops, grazing things on them, and butterflies and what have you, rabbits and birds in general. But I'd be very curious to hear if there's been time spent or allocated studying the effect of various crop sprays on sandhill cranes in particular, because of the impact on the immune systems of these animals. And if these sprays and eating those seeds and, you know, dropped crop particles, for example, if it is possibly creating a higher rate of avian flu susceptibility. And then as far as overcrowding, I agree, you know, these species enjoy hanging out together, although in many cases sandhill cranes seem to kind of separate a little bit while they're raising their chicks. But as far as, let's take the Bay Beach Wildlife Nature Center, which has become extremely populated with geese, and I see a lot of unhealthy-looking geese and ducks, but what are they being fed? A lot of commercial crop corn, and I'm wondering if there is a connection. And so that was my comment. I'd be so curious to hear the answer.
Okay. Anne, do you want to take a crack at that?
I'll start and then pass it off to Diana, because that is a great question, Joe. Thank you. And that is something that I have been curious about for a long time. Sandhills are part and parcel with our agricultural landscape in Wisconsin. It's one of the reasons why it has had such a great comeback, is we have a lot of wetlands, but also they have adapted to our human-dominated landscape and all that agricultural area. So Diana and I are actually starting a study looking at just what the exposure is, what these birds are carrying as part of what agrochemicals they're being exposed to and carrying around. At the 10,000-foot view is that the population is growing and it's doing quite well. So it can't be a lethal effect, at least, but are there some sublethal effects? And that's one thing that we're looking for that way. And maybe Diana can talk more about what those things could be. You were talking about the immune system and more susceptibility to avian influenza, question
mark.
Yeah.
Diana?
Yeah, Joe, and I think that's a great question. You know, and I'm just going to start off that I don't have the answer for that yet. You know, the fact that we do see birds in the high congregations are more stressed and they're showing higher stress related behaviors. And we know that in multiple species and in humans that higher stress lowers your immune system. So, you know, it's assumed that that is an issue, that, you know, and a lot of these stresses that we're putting on cranes, you know, are going to catch up with them at some point. And, you know, whether it's avian influenza or another disease or related to the agricultural use of chemicals is to be seen. You know, and I would say to your point on, you know, looking at waterfowl that are fed crops and stuff like that, I think that the one benefit with cranes is they're really omnivorous, so they have a pretty varied diet. So it's not that one thing in particular is going to have such a overarching effect on their total nutrition, because they have a lot of options available for them, especially in healthy wetlands.
Let's take an email here. Bill, actually, this is a call. Bill had called but couldn't stay with us. How can you tell if a dead bird has avian flu, and what should you do with the bird if you think it died from avian flu influenza? Should you take it somewhere?
Bill, that is a fantastic question. Thank you for asking that one. During the migration season in particular, like the way that I look at it as a veterinarian is that if I see a dead bird and I see a dead wild bird, my first thought is avian influenza. Probably my second and third thought are the same answer. But there are other things that can cause deaths, and especially multitude of deaths. But right now we're just seeing such a prevalence of avian influenza. If you see a dead bird, I would report it to DNR, Wisconsin DNR. They're the ones that are going to be handling it, especially on a lot of the refuges. And there is a risk to people with this virus. So within the ICF staff, we really try to protect our staff by not having them touch dead birds without a lot of the personal protective equipment that we have on if we actually need to grab a bird, and especially we have all that on if we need to grab a sick bird. Gloves and mask and face shield, change your clothes. One of the biggest things too is that if you're in an area where you're seeing a lot of dead waterfowl in particular, be really cautious of the shoes that you're wearing and where your car's been before you go to another similar area, because you can transmit the virus both on your shoes, and it's mostly the wheel wells of your car. So what we'll do is we'll change shoes, so we have site-dedicated shoes, and if we've been somewhere, we just run our car through a car wash so that we know that we're not acting as a way to transmit that virus other places that it isn't already.
Yeah, regardless of whether it's avian influenza, and again, you know, Occam's razor says it might very well be, it's great to report it, because if it's not that, it might be something else. All of it is something we should know about and be concerned about. So yeah, search the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources site for dead bird report or something like that. It'll get you to the site, and it's really important to report those.
Good question. Michael emailed us. Michael says that between 2009 I forget. He doesn't give the second. I don't have the second. He had a range here. He thought that about 80, somewhere between 80 and $100 million was spent on captive breeding whooping cranes and four release projects. The first two releases didn't work. Have the remaining two projects produced a self-sustaining populations of hoopers?
Yeah, he's thinking of how much it costs to raise a whooping crane, and that's something that we're actually trying to document. You know, it's a lot of money.
He was taking a guess there from the sound of it.
Yeah, and that was the early days of our whooping crane reintroduction here in Wisconsin when we had multiple different release techniques, including the ultralight migration, which we don't do anymore, but we are still it still costs a lot of money to raise these birds up, raise them right, put them out in the landscape with our partners. There have been two previous reintroductions. The first was Gray's Lake out in the Rocky Mountains for whooping crane migratory population, and a non-migratory attempt in Florida, and those did not work out. So there are two current ones here in Wisconsin and another non-migratory population that is ongoing down in Louisiana that is doing great. They have at least 80 birds in their population now, not yet self-sustaining. Obviously, ours in Wisconsin is not, but the one in Louisiana, non-migratory birds have a lot less threats and a lot less risk to their life during the annual cycle. But they do have their threats down there, and the challenges continue, but it's looking very, very good for that population.
And thinking about funding, how do you guys fund the International Crane Foundation? After all, it's a foundation.
It is. We're a member-based organization, so we would love for people to become a member and join our flock to support our work globally. But we have a lot of private foundations, and our grant writers are working 24/7. They are the best to help us fund our many, many projects worldwide. But the whooping cranes in particular were supported by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. These being an endangered species, these are property of the people. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service kind of takes the forefront of, you know, all whooping crane populations, both in human care and in the wild. And so that is a lot of our support comes from them. And at this difficult time, we think of our friends in the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we wish them well.
Yeah. Bob in Kewaunee has a quick question. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Well, good afternoon. First, I'd like to say that I have been fortunate enough to have several sightings here in the Kewaunee area of whooping cranes, always a single crane, and almost always in the company of sandhills. Which brings me to my question, will they interbreed with the sandhills?
Will they? Well, they have. that first reintroduction that I described out in the Rocky Mountains, those were whooping crane eggs that were placed in the nests of sandhills because they're great parents and they can teach them the migratory route, which they did, but they're also imprinted on sandhills. So famously, cranes don't have mirrors, and so they didn't realize that they were big white birds. Here in the eastern population, probably a result of them being very, very few in number and hanging out with their sandhill cousins, we do have one example of a hybrid chick that was produced out of a sandhill whooping crane pairing from Horicon National Wildlife Refuge. But that's the only one that we've documented. But again, it's probably because he was trying to find a mate and he couldn't find a whooping crane, so decided a sandhill would be just fine.
And on that happy note, hey, listen, if you haven't been to the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo yet, I strongly encourage you to get over there and join up with the organization and support it. Diana Boone and Ann Lacey, thank you so much for representing the organization and for being with us.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure. Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening in today. This is a kind of a team effort here. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, part of the Larry Mueller Show, as our Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and of course our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Been a lot of fun and interesting times here on the show today. Thank you so much for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.